Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Welcome one and all to the Mona Charon Show. I am delighted to be joined this week by Richard Kallenberg. He is of the Progressive Policy Institute and author of many books, most recently, Class Matters. Now, this is one of those really, really long subtitles, but I understand why you chose this long subtitle. It does kind of tell the story. So here it is. Ready? The fight to get beyond race preferences, reduce inequality, and build real diversity at America's colleges. Richard Kallenberg, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, great to be with you, Mona.
So let's start with a little background about you. You have been involved in these debates, public policy debates about affirmative action for many years. You talk in the book a lot about your early inspirations. So you're a man of the Democratic Party, of the left, moderate left, I would say. And you were very influenced by Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy. So why don't you tell that story and tell us, where you were born, what kind of a family you come from. Give us your background.
Okay, great. So I was born in Washington, D.C. to a liberal, socially conscious, upper middle class white family. And my father was a liberal Presbyterian minister. My mother was a school board member, so civic minded, and I went off to college at Harvard and was around a lot of people who were upper middle class, no matter what their race was. They were an almost all liberal, but I came of age, during Ronald Reagan's presidency, and so that kind of made me think a little bit, maybe start to rethink my politics and go back to a better time, in my view, when liberals were pushing for kind of a broad working class coalition, multiracial working class coalition. My two inspirations were Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. Senior, these days.
you hasten to add.
Yes, yes. So I wrote my thesis in college about RFK's 1968 campaign for president, when he did bring together working people of all races. So he was, you know, a champion of civil rights, was kind of the face of the civil rights efforts of the Kennedy administration as attorney general. And at the same time was able to appeal to working class white voters, some of whom had voted for George Wallace, you know, the segregationist governor in previous presidential elections. So this was when he was running for president in 1968, Indiana and elsewhere. He brought together this remarkable coalition. And he did so by emphasizing the same themes that Martin Luther King was headed toward, which is that with passage of civil rights laws, the bigger issue facing America was economic inequality. And so King argued that we did need to address our history of discrimination after passage of civil rights laws. It wasn't enough simply to outlaw discrimination, but that it was important that going forward, the kind of the remedy for past discrimination would be economic in character. And so King called for a Bill of Rights for disadvantaged people of all races, rather than a special Bill of Rights for Black people. And, you know, he thought that that would be important to growing the multiracial working class coalition. He thought that it was a simple matter of justice that poor whites be given a leg up, as well as, you know, those who had been victims of discrimination. And he recognized that because of past discrimination, precisely because of past discrimination, that Black people would disproportionately benefit from an economic-based program. And therefore, you know, it wasn't as if the economic approach ignored history. So that was my inspiration, and I've been running with that in the decades since then, but it's made me unpopular with a lot of my friends on the left.
Okay, so what is wrong with the way affirmative action was implemented, in your opinion?
Well, there were a number of things wrong with it. I mean, the first is that in the university setting, a lot of elite universities were racially integrated, but economically segregated. And so I think it's a beautiful thing that a place like Harvard is majority-minority. I celebrate that. But they also had, at one point, 22 times as many rich students as low-income students. So it was ignoring this bigger issue of class. You know, the research shows that over the last 50, 60 years, race has become less important in determining your odds of success in America. And your economic status, the economic status you're born into, has become increasingly important. And yet, institutions of higher education, you know, gave, I think, legitimate concern to the issues of race, but ignored the issues of class. So that was one problem with affirmative action, is that it ignored this huge issue. Let me
stop you there for a sec and ask you this, because I can imagine a lot of people are going to say, hold on, are you really saying that your class is more, if you're born poor or disadvantaged economically, that that's more of an obstacle than being born Black? Are you saying that about 2025 America?
Absolutely. I mean, it's been true for a number of years. And there's careful research that was done by a Georgetown professor, Anthony Carnevale, who kind of tried to figure out, well, what predicts your SAT score? You know, what are the disadvantages that predict lower test scores? And it is true that there is a large gap between Black and white students. But most of that gap is related to the fact that Black students are much more likely to be economically disadvantaged and working class than white students. And so when he totaled up the disadvantages, the difference between the most economically disadvantaged and least economically disadvantaged students was 399 points on the SAT. And the Black white test score gap that was not explained by economics was 56 points, so much smaller. So I'm not saying that race is irrelevant in American society. Of course it is. It's just that race matters, but class matters a lot more. And our universities weren't, as they like to say, following the science. They weren't trying to actually create a fair system in which you would give credit for students who had overcome obstacles. I mean, if someone grew up in a single parent home, a poor neighborhood, and went to lousy schools and managed to do pretty well despite that, then that suggests there's something really special about that individual student, and they deserve some extra consideration. They're better than they look just on paper. And so I think that's, you know, if you look at public opinion polling, that's where most Americans are. They want to recognize obstacles overcome. But today, that those are primarily economic rather than racial in character.
So I found many parts of your book really interesting. One of them was the Strivers program. Talk to us a little bit about that and what happened there.
Yes. So the people behind the SAT recognized that there were unfairnesses in that program. And so they created a system that would recognize disadvantage and quantify it. And the Georgetown professor I mentioned earlier, Anthony Carnevale, was part of that Strivers research. And what was interesting is it showed that
Describe what it was.
Yes, it would basically quantify the disadvantages associated with socioeconomic status and give students give colleges the information that they could
flag,
then,
right? Yes, say yes. This is a kid who's like in a poor rural school that usually doesn't produce, you know, college-bound students, or that, you know, has low tends to have low scores or whatever. And here's this gal who, you know, is scoring 650 or something like that, right?
That's right. You would identify these students who'd done a lot better than you'd expect them to, given the environment they found themselves in. But then something interesting happened, which is that the research, which showed that you could get racial diversity if you identified strivers, was quashed because civil rights groups did not want this. They did not want to see the Supreme Court shift the basis strike down the use of race, which would result in institutions instead looking at socioeconomic status. They liked the system the way it was, and universities did too. You know, they didn't want the Strivers Project because it's much cheaper for them to provide a preference to upper middle class, polished Black and Hispanic students who will not require a lot of financial aid. So there was no real constituency for the Strivers Project, and so the College Board ended up killing it.
There's so much going on in politics, it can be hard to get a proper breakdown on everything that's going on right now. But that's why the NPR Politics podcast is where I go to decode what goes down in Washington and what every decision out there might mean for me and you. First impressions are always important. All this week, the NPR Politics podcast is unpacking the first 100 days of Trump's second presidency. They're tackling what's been done, what's to come, and what might change, and as always, what it means for you, the listener. Every episode makes it easy for you to understand what's going on, from the complete restructure of the federal government to immigration policy, tariffs, and trade. These 100 days have been monumental. Has Trump lived up to his early promises? Will his executive orders and spur-the-moment decision-making change the U.S. and your life in the long term? Every day, the NPR Politics podcast team will focus on one thing and boil it down to 15 minutes or less. Think of it as your political multivitamin. If you need to be kept up to date on the latest mess the Trump administration has made of the country, this team of reporters has you covered. Listen now to the NPR Politics podcast, only from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
Do you ever look at political headlines and go, huh? Well, that's exactly why the NPR Politics podcast exists. We're experts, not just on politics, but in making politics make sense. Every episode, we decode everything that happened in Washington and help you figure out what it all means. Give politics a chance with the NPR Politics Podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts.
So let's get into that. That's a big part of your argument. So I would like you to explain a little bit in a little bit more depth. I will quote you. You say that, for example, the Grutter decision that was authored by former Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, that this was actually a victory for wealthy white people because she basically said, you know, you can keep affirmative. She took the arguments of the big, you know, institutional players here at face value, that they really thought this was best and that they had no other ulterior motives. Yes. And was that the decision in which she said, you know, like in 25 years, you should maybe stop? Okay.
Yes.
So, and then you write, supporters and beneficiaries of legacy preferences, they like that racial preferences give college admissions an appearance of fairness, thereby propping up their own form of affirmative action for the wealthy. So let's get into that. You argue that universities want to give the appearance of being fair, and it's easier to look fair by having racial diversity, which is visible, than by having economic diversity, which is less visible. But that basically they are cherry picking these Black students who actually, and Hispanic students who don't really need a leg up because they're already heavily upper middle class or upper class even. And you quoted Barack Obama as saying, you know, before he became president, but he said he wasn't really sure his daughters needed to get an advantage when they were applying to college because, you know, they were the children of two lawyers and, you know, a politician, et cetera. So that's your argument. So can you back that up, that these students that they've been admitting are not really needy? They are the already privileged? What do you say
yes.
to that?
Well, there are a number of studies that find this, including studies of strong supporters of affirmative action. A number of years ago, Derek Bach, the former president of Harvard, wrote a book that was in defense of affirmative action, and he found that 86% of the Black students at the group of selective college, small group of selective colleges they had data on, were middle or upper middle class. More recently, I was involved as an expert witness in the cases against Harvard and the University of North Carolina that, and, you know, landed in the Supreme Court and ended up striking down racial preferences. Mm-hmm. And in that case, the data showed that 71% of the Black, Hispanic, and Native American students at Harvard came from the richest 20% of the Black, Hispanic, and Native American populations nationally. So it's not that Barack Obama's kids were the exception to the rule. Quite the contrary. That was kind of the model that elite institutions like Harvard had used. And there were similar data in the University of North Carolina case. Part of the problem is the process is so opaque, you don't really know this information in most cases, but litigation brings out the details. And that's what we found at both of those universities.
Yeah. So since you mentioned it, let's talk a little bit about that. This was Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard and UNC, right? So the discovery process revealed a lot of pretty unattractive things that certainly Harvard was doing. I think UNC too, where they were discriminating against Asian students actively, and thereby, and then also not just that, but they were also giving a huge advantage to the children of faculty, the children of donors, the children of alumni. And when you add that all, and athletes, you add that all up, and the number of preferences that are going to the wealthy or the already privileged, you could say, goes, you know, is pretty high, kind of shockingly high, yes. I thought.
Yes. Well, this is a system that that universities did not want out in the open, and it was only because there was a discovery process where they had to provide all this information that it came out. But there were the biggest preference at Harvard was for recruited athletes, and one thinks, you know, often thinks of the basketball team or the football team. Well, this is a diverse group economically, racially, but that's not the full picture. In many of these students actually come from very, very wealthy backgrounds. So it's for the fencing team, the crew team, for kind of boutique sports. And it's basically
the
a
lacrosse
way to,
team.
That's right. It's a way to get around need blind admissions. So these institutions really feel proud of the fact, and it is a good thing that they don't hold it against students that they're low income. But in fact, they've got all these preferences for the children of donors, children of faculty, legacies, athletes that end up being, in essence, affirmative action for the wealthy. And there's this, as you were saying, you know, a kind of a weird symbiotic relationship between racial preferences and all these other preferences. And racial preferences helped justify and
put window
prop
dressing
up the others. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that is, yeah, it's not. And then of course there was that whole scandal about people buying, what was the name of that scandal?
The Varsity Blues scandal.
Varsity Blues. Thank you. Yeah. Where, you know, celebrities were actually just paying to get their kids athletic scholarships when their kids weren't even athletes. And I mean,
yes.
It was really stank. I mean, truly corrupt.
Yes. Now that was a little different in the sense it was bribing coaches and cheating on the SAT. But
yes.
But the distinction was only one of, it was a distinction in degree rather than, rather than something really morally different because lots of people were buying their way into universities. It's just some were writing the checks to Harvard and UNC, and others were writing the checks to these coaches. And the
right.
second is illegal. The first is
perfectly legal.
Right.
Or it was. Yeah. So actually, you quote from some of the discovery that they found. And, you know, one guy, his name is redacted, but it's, you know, like, so-and-so will provide a building. You know, please admit this. This boy, this man's son.
Yes.
Pretty clear. Okay. So then talk a little bit about the economic incentives here, because you say that universities also, they don't want to do affirmative action for the disadvantaged, the economically disadvantaged, even though that would yield, by the way, the same number of minority admittees. But they don't want to do that because it costs them more money, right?
Yes. I mean, that's why they resisted economic or class-based affirmative action for decades and said racial preference. They claimed racial preferences is the only way to get racial diversity. That was wrong, but that was their claim, and they had a massive financial incentive for doing so. But as a left-of-center Democrat, my theory of action was that if racial preferences became outlawed, then universities would instead shift to economic affirmative action. That was kind of really the only conditions under which they would begin providing economic affirmative action. And it's not that it became any cheaper. It's still expensive. It's just that that's the only game in town now if you're trying to get racial diversity. And I think to their credit, these institutions do want and do value racial diversity. And so we've seen, you know, since the Supreme Court decision in Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard and UNC that universities have taken steps to increase their economic diversity and they're getting a fair amount of racial diversity as well.
Most people don't realize how much of their personal information is out there and how hard it is to get it back under control. your name, address, phone number, even your online activity. It's all being collected and sold without your consent. That's what fuels the spam, the scam calls, and real threats like identity theft. And while it's possible to remove your data, the process is deliberately confusing and time-consuming. It's not designed for people to succeed on their own. Privacy Hawk cuts through that. It tracks where your data is being shared, works to remove it, and keeps watch so you don't have to. Privacy Hawk gives you a simple way to take control of your personal data. It scans data broker sites to find where your information is being shared and works to get it removed. Privacy Hawk keeps monitoring and alerts you if your data shows up in a breach or on the dark web. And if something does go wrong, you're covered with up to $1 million. With up to $1 million in identity theft insurance and expert help to recover. I didn't realize how much privacy I had sacrificed with my various scrollings and putting in your address and various information on different websites. But now that I have Privacy Hawk, I am grateful for the peace of mind when it comes to the security of my personal data. So there are a number of states who had long been doing this. And so what are some of the ways that you can get a racially and ethnically diverse student body that's also economically diverse? How can you do that?
Yeah, well, there's a whole menu of options that have been developed over time. So one thing universities can do is rely on more transfers from community colleges to four-year institutions.
We have that at the University of Virginia, by the way. They take a bunch of kids from community colleges if they mm-hmm. do really well in community college.
That's right. I mean, there are so many students who choose community college for financial reasons and are very, very bright and can do the work at a place like UVA and other top institutions. And so that's one avenue. Another is to recalibrate your admissions system so that you eliminate some of the preferences for advantage groups like legacies and children of faculty, and instead provide a meaningful boost in admissions chances for economically disadvantaged students of all races. Increasing financial aid is obviously important, both to make it possible for students who are admitted to attend, but also to send a signal more broadly to applicants that even if you're from a low income or working class background, you will have a real chance of coming here because we're going to provide that financial aid. So that's another important avenue. And I'll just mention one more. The University of Texas pioneered an interesting plan. They call it the top 10% plan, in which students from who have the top grades across high schools in Texas are automatically admitted to UT Austin. And so that means that students who come from, poor rural school districts, high schools, students from poor urban school districts, now suddenly had a chance to go to UT Austin. And there was an empirical question, how would these students do academically? But they've done quite well. They've proven themselves over time. And so that's a really important alternative method of getting racial diversity by, in essence, looking at geographic but also economic diversity.
And would you favor taking into account is it just poverty you're looking at or hardship, or are you also looking at a kid who was taking care of his sick grandmother or things like that in a kid's life history, growing up with a single mother or other kinds of disadvantage?
I think all of those types of disadvantages are relevant and really get to creating a fair system where you're looking at accomplishments of a student in light of what obstacles they faced. And I should say, I would also include overcoming racial discrimination. I mean, I do think that I'm glad the Supreme Court allowed that in the Students for Fair Admissions decision, that if a student can demonstrate that they face some real serious racial discrimination, here's how they overcame that. That ought to be something that a fair admissions process would consider.
What do you make of the argument that they have to do legacy admissions, that is, the children of alumni, in order to maintain some connection with the school's past, a sense of continuity, and also donations from alumni? What do you make of that argument?
Yeah, well, so that's always been the argument, that you put kind of this patina of nobility around what is really, to my mind, a pretty sordid practice of looking at a student's ancestry as opposed to their individual merits. And I edited a volume called Affirmative Action for the Rich back in 2010. And one of the chapters did an empirical analysis. They looked at 75 institutions that had legacy preferences, 25 that did not, and found that there was no difference in level of giving with those who had the legacy preferences versus those who don't. And it's hard for people to believe that. They think, well, how can that be possible? But there's another study which provides one explanation, which is that it is true that when alumni children are in high school, they do start giving more money because they want to buy their way into the institution for their kid. But then when students are rejected, the alumni are so furious that they stop giving altogether. And as these institutions become more and more competitive, even a lot of legacy students are rejected. So the business model doesn't really hold up the way way that it used to. I think that if a university really said, we absolutely need to provide some sort of preference to wealthy people in order to get, in order to make ends meet, I'd be for a more transparent system where you just auction off a certain number of seats, 10 seats in this class, highest bidder.
Highest bidder.
Why limit it to alumni? Just anyone.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine being the student who goes to school and it's like, oh, so your father gave $5 million to put you here? I don't think so.
well, interestingly, there is this. When I went to college, and I'll admit, I was a legacy student. My father went to Harvard, and there was no stigma associated with that whatsoever. Kind of unfairly, the black students did have stigma associated with their admissions. That's changed. I talked to folks today who say that now people do know who the legacy students are, and there is a stigma associated with it. So I think it would just be a little more, it would be more open under this auction process.
Speaking of stigma, talk about the differences between a system of racial preferences and the stigma associated with being an affirmative action admittee versus if it were all done on the basis of disadvantage and class instead of race. Talk about that a bit.
Yes. Well, the notion of stigma is associated with the idea that, that the preference is undeserved. So we don't say that you only got into this school because you had high grades and test scores.
Right.
Because people feel like those are legitimate criteria. And here's where the polling is important, because people feel like two-thirds of Americans say it's completely legitimate to consider the economic disadvantages that someone has overcome in life. Whereas racial preferences are deeply unpopular, vast majorities of Americans oppose, including majorities of black people, oppose consideration of race in admissions, according to the Pew Research Center. So I don't think there would be a stigma associated with overcoming economic disadvantage the way there is with race, because the consideration is is thought of as legitimate by most people.
And again, your research, the research you cite in the book suggests that if we switched, and we're going to, because the Supreme Court has ruled that racial preferences are no longer acceptable, you say that going by economic disadvantage will yield the same, about the same number of seats for Blacks, Hispanics, Native Americans, et cetera?
Yes. Well, it to be careful here, it matters how you define socioeconomic status. So if you look only at income, that will not yield the same level of racial diversity as racial preferences do. And the reason is that there are Black and white people in America of the same income level still face very different economic odds. So astonishingly, poor whites live in neighborhoods that have higher levels of income on average than upper middle class Black people. So neighborhood matters to life chances, and that's something, you know, not that all Black people face, it's not a disadvantage all Black people face, but disproportionately Black people face that disadvantage. The other big factor is wealth, that is your accumulated assets over time. And there's a substantial income gap between Black and white people in America, a gargantuan wealth gap. And that has to do with the legacy of enslavement, redlining, segregation, and
discrimination.
Absolutely. Those are all forms of racial discrimination, if you consider wealth, and if you consider neighborhood, as well as family income, and whether you come from a single parent home, if you have a comprehensive set of socioeconomic indicators, then you can get close to the same level of racial diversity. I'm not for proportional representation. I don't think that should be the goal per se. And you mentioned earlier, the anti-Asian discrimination at Harvard. Proportional representation is would end up helping, hurting groups that have shown a real commitment to education. Asian Americans, Jewish Americans. I mean, there are a whole group of people who are
Indians, subcontinent people,
who outperform, and we ought not say that. Well, if the share of each group doesn't line up precisely, that's somehow a problem. That's not what one does in a free society.
Right. Not fair. So let's talk a little bit about your sense of the importance of this issue over the last several decades in terms of the culture, in terms of our politics. Do you think, as you imply, as I think I take this from your book, that you think there's this sense of unfairness and resentment that is sort of maybe not that far beneath the surface, maybe it's pretty close to the surface at this point, among white working class people, that the system is not set up to favor them, that it's rigged against them, and that part of that, I hate that language when it comes out of Trump's mouth. But when it's referring to something like this, it does seem a little bit more understandable that some people would look at the system and say, well, hang on, you get what, 100-point like bonus if you have the right skin color to get into Harvard. And if you're just a white guy from, Oklahoma, you don't get anything. And that does seem, so how much do you think that has propelled the movement of the white working class toward Republicans?
Yeah, I think it's actually very significant. Now I want to be careful here, because if you look at public opinion polls on what matters in elections, the issue of, who gets into University of North Carolina is not is not salient.
It doesn't show up. Right?
Yeah, no. So I don't want to suggest that it's a single issue that people are voting on.
But having what do you think that, people are responding to in polls where they say, mm-hmm. you know, do you think that white people face as much discrimination as black people? And they say yes.
Yes. And the only, to my mind, the only logical interpretation of that is that they see racial preferences as discrimination.
Yeah.
So I'm very careful. I use the word racial preferences rather than discrimination because I think there is a difference between trying to consider race in order to integrate an institution as opposed to, Bull Connor discriminating against black people. I think there is a distinction. Having said that, there's a huge political cost to saying that the preferences, would be based on race rather than class. And King saw that, and Robert Kennedy saw that, and Bayard Rustin, one of King's aides, was very clear on this question. And he said that in a multiracial society, anytime you align preferences based on skin color, you're going to get a backlash. And that's precisely what has happened. So I think the costs in terms of the political coalition that that left of center people have dreamed of has been substantial. And when Ronald Trump says the system is rigged, he's talking about a number of things. But one of the things he's talking about there is a system of racial preferences. I think that's why he's leaned so hard into DEI programs, is that he knows that's a winning issue for him. When he gave an address before Congress recently, and he said, we ought to be about merit rather than DEI. And you had Democrats sitting there stony-faced and Republicans cheering. That was a good moment for Donald Trump politically. And it pains me because, like all of you at the Bulwark, I'm extremely upset about so much of what Donald Trump does. And I think that as Bill Maher has said, the best form of resistance is moving to the center and beating candidates like Trump. And so I think, moving away from racial preferences would be hugely symbolic to working Americans that in fact, Trump isn't on their side, that Democrats and reasonable Republicans are.
I feel constrained to just point out, because I can't resist, that of course the Trump administration practices an unbelievable kind of affirmative action for cranks, morons, Trump toadies, utterly unqualified people are now in charge of our major government offices. So he says it ought to be about merit, but he doesn't mean merit in the same way that we do.
And when Pete Hegseth makes these arguments in favor of merit, it's hard to take seriously.
Yes, exactly. But it's important to bear in mind that despite all of that, there is a serious case to be made that we needed to move away from race preferences and toward a fairer system. So how is it going? Let's close on this. How is it going so far? The decision came down in 2023, I think.
Yes.
So it's 2025. How's it going?
I think it's going quite well. There was an open question after the decision, what would happen? It was possible that universities would just give up on diversity and not pursue economic affirmative action. But we've seen a number of institutions, Yale, Dartmouth, others reporting record levels of socioeconomic diversity. Since we filed the litigation against Harvard, they've tripled the number of first generation college students. And then racial diversity, not surprisingly, has followed at many of these institutions. Now, I want to be clear, we don't know exactly what they're doing behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. So it is possible that in addition to using economic affirmative action to get racial diversity, they could be cheating. I don't know. But I don't want to suggest that that we know precisely what they're doing. We don't. But there are some positive indicators that universities are shifting the basis of affirmative action from race to class, and that they're getting positive results. They were all predicting catastrophe in terms of racial diversity. And a few institutions, to be fair, did see substantial declines in Black shares, like MIT and Amherst. But the really powerful story here is that most institutions, Princeton, Duke, Yale, Harvard, UVA, have done well with both racial and economic diversity in this post-racial preferences era.
Okay, I lied. One final question, and that is, what about the argument that you will frequently hear that, look, all of this focus on, you know, the top 20 most selective schools in the country is misplaced. Most people never even go, you know, will never go, would never consider going, and it's not all that important. How do you respond to that?
I agree and disagree. So I've spent a lot of time in my career on strengthening community colleges, because that is where the vast majority of working class people in America go. They're not going to elite institutions. So I take the point. At the same time, the reason I spent much of my time also on these elite institutions is that it matters who goes, that there is research finding that roughly half of government leaders and half of corporate leaders in America come from just 12 rich, selective universities. In the book, I quote Joe Biden talking about the river of power in America. Now, Joe Biden is an exception to the rule, obviously. He did not go to a selective college or law school, but he recognized that, when he got to Washington, he saw all these folks from elite institutions. And he said, you know, a lot of people they don't know about the river of power. Some look on over the edges and want to get in but can't. But he said there's a river of power in America that runs through the Ivy League and through these other selective colleges. And I think we should just face that fact. Maybe we don't like that fact, but it does matter who goes. And I'd rather those institutions have more people who face some difficult odds in life, know what it's like to struggle, and hopefully would reflect that, therefore, in the public policy that they make.
Plus reducing resentment between classes, right? I mean, if you feel like you don't stand a chance of moving up or gaining, you know, the brass ring because of where you were born, that can lead to a great deal of depression and resentment and a feeling that the system doesn't work and isn't fair.
Absolutely. I'm glad you raised that. That's an enormously important point. We have to have, you know, pathways to leadership open to all. And when you don't, then you do, I think, get someone like Donald Trump says the system's rigged against you. Makes the false claim that he will defend those the interests of those folks.
All right. Well, the book is called Class Matters. I'm not going to reread the subtitle. You heard that at the beginning. Richard Kallenberg, thanks so much for joining me.
Wonderful to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.